ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
I think that there has always been this flickering, hopeful yearning to talk of beauty in the face of human suffering, to talk of connection, to talk of love, all of that. And it's something that I cherish and I want to hang on to. It has given me ideas, experiences, language, opportunities to explore some of the perhaps ineffable things of life.
Hope and connection, beauty and love, these are things that animate Lorna Hallahan's life. She's one of the country's fiercest disability scholars and advocates. For half a century, she's been thinking about how disability matters to how we find meaning as a community and in our own lives.
We are all poor creatures born to die. We all face human frailty, and so that is universal human experience. But what happens historically is that certain categories of people who manifest that human frailty in spectacular or disturbing ways get treated differently from others. And that is what is disability. The social construction of the other person with impairments that shakes up our view about what it means to be human.
Hello, I'm Meredith Lake, and in this episode of Soul Search, I'm delighted to be speaking with Lorna Hallahan. As the world marks the International Day of People with Disability on December the 3rd, and as Christians enter the season of Advent. Hello, Lorna.
Hello, Meredith. It's lovely to hear you.
There's so much that I want to talk about with you. But firstly, we met back in May, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
What have you been up to since then?
I've been teaching. I've worked with a group of people and we published a couple of really interesting articles on lived experience and disability and the notion of expertise and experience. And I'm just about to embark on working with a fabulous team of people on a history of disability in the family.
I mean, you're an academic. Expertise is an interesting idea. In your field as a sociologist, what does expertise signal?
Well, what we're trying to do in these articles is to say that there's a step beyond just saying this happened to me and into a question of what does this mean in the context of the big questions of our day that relate to people with disability, to not just see ourselves as people who have to deliver a narrative of suffering into the world, but as people who have are really, through that really concentrated effort, some really key messages about meaning and purpose and direction of change.
Why is it important to talk about meaning in the context of something that might seem as technical as disability policy? I mean, this is something you've come to after years of research and reflection. So how
too many years.
No,
I'm just about to celebrate 50 years of thinking about this stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe then take me back 50 years. Where would you say, do you begin to narrate that to yourself?
Yeah, I think just to say something about the meaning question and then I will go back there. But it's about the fact that meaning is constructed around us rather than by us. And so we have to step into a conversation about how disability is understood within the wider society and what that means as it happens to people. And so my experience goes back to my being a teenager diagnosed with cancer and losing my leg and really having to reach into my faith tradition, my the sort of early start of my education to try and find a meaning in what was happening to me, even though it felt meaningless, but also realizing that there were so many people around me, clergy, people connected to my church, people in my family, who instantly came to me with their meanings about what this was and tried to kind of enlist me in that. And so as I still have this vast collection of cards and letters that people wrote to me at that point. And there are people who say a range of things that that are really pious platitudes about why a girl like me should get sick and end up in that situation. And as I looked at all of those constructions of meaning for my experience, I realized that there was no clear message in this and that I would have to find my own path through it.
I mean, somewhat glibly, it's easy to describe human beings as meaning-making creatures, but not everything is easily distilled in terms of its meaning. And maybe we struggle with the way some things might resist easy meaning.
I think what happens is that people are fairly comfortable with meaning structures. God's in her heaven, we're on earth, Jesus did this big sacrificial thing for us, you know, those kinds of ideas. And then when something that doesn't fit that script happens, people struggle. And what they struggle with is being able to incorporate this human experience with their doctrinal grasp of the world. And so a lot of the stuff that I encountered at that time, and of course over the last 50 years, and in the reading that I did as I went into my doctoral studies, was what I call keeping God gorgeous, which was a way of trying to find an explanation for meaningless human suffering that still keeps God omniscient, omnipresent, all omnibenevolent, all of that, a God in control. And so it's the deep question of theodicy, which is the kind of theological category that we put these questions in, about if God's so wonderful and so vested in human happiness, how come these sorts of things happen? And what's more, why can't God just step in and do something miraculous? In fact, I had at that point in my life people who said to me, I remember I was a very, very ill 16-year-old. They said to me, you shouldn't have treatment for this, that you should demonstrate to your community that God is in control and that your leg will grow back and that you will be cured from cancer and your faith will shine through and bring other people. And so there was a not a recognition of the calamity that I was in, but rather a desperate, I think, sadly desperate attempt to keep God in the control place. And I think over the years I've just said that's not where it's at, actually.
That is a lot for a 16-year-old to bear. Lorna.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were other things about God only gives you things that you can handle. You're a tough girl. You'll get through this. God's using you to show something to the rest of the world, not necessarily that kind of miraculous restoration to health, but that you will be a shining light for people, all this sort of stuff. Wow. And nobody really came to me and said, this is really tricky. This really tests what we hold as dear. What are we going to learn from this? How are we going to make sense of this? How can we recognize that in these experiences we leave the safe shore of established doctrine and go into really quite troubled waters, and how are we going to maintain a sense of not being abandoned? For me, that was important in that space, because as a consequence of all of this, I did experience abandonment. I had to leave my home, my school, everything, and go into a medical and rehabilitation cycle that took 2 years, and I did that alone. And so I needed something that held me as well as something that I could hold. And I realized that I didn't need all of those platitudinous scripts for this. What I needed was a sense that my life was valued, that I retained dignity, that no matter where this would end, in my death or in 50 years of life, which is pretty remarkable given where I was, that there was something that was a core about being beloved.
Lorna, so many of us have to come to terms with our bodies, right?
Mm-hmm.
As they change for whatever reason, sometimes for traumatic reasons, sometimes mm-hmm. in much more expected ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that as a society we are very good at that. How did you navigate that back then? I mean, how did you hold on to a sense of your own dignity and integrity? Or was that something hard won that came later? I mean, that's a huge recalibration.
Yes, it is. I think there were a number of things. For most of the time, I just felt mutilated and depleted and kind of in horror with what was happening with my body, but also knowing that I couldn't occupy any other body, so I had to kind of take it with me. And that, so it was probably the first time in my life that I had to face up to my body, because before that I was just a brain and a mouth with a body attached to it, and then all of a sudden I had to experience it in this struggle. And that was not easy to hold on to that. And so I think the important thing for me actually was getting a lover when I was 19. Mm. And that there was this sort of sense of, yes, you're beautiful, you're not mutilated. And so it was that transition into the next part of my adult life that made it possible for me to start to see myself from the inside rather than looking with the gaze that had been trained into me through my childhood and adolescent years as someone who was diminished and broken. And that really took me into doing my doctoral studies, when I realized that I was reading stuff about disability and theology, which talked about people having broken bodies, broken minds, broken lives, and had begun to experience myself as having a life-giving body, a strong body, a desirable body, a body that got me doing the things that were mostly what I wanted to be doing.
And that disruptive meaning also in a way was a gift from outside yourself.
Yes, indeed. And over time I have come to see that it is actually in our relationships that we transform some of this stuff. It's not just an internal quest. And so I think that we harm people with impairments by constructing relationships which diminish their dignity and rights, and we can also restore dignity and rights by having the right sorts of relationships with people and being open to the gifts of the people rather than the burdens of the people.
You're listening to Soul Search on Radio National, and I'm speaking with Lorna Hallahan. She's an Associate Professor of Sociology at Flinders University in Adelaide. And we're talking about how disability is an all of us thing, however we experience human frailty in our lives right now.
the first thing is we are all, as Dylan Thomas said, poor creatures born to die. We all face human frailty. And so I do not see myself as separate from any other human being on the planet about having to deal with physical and psychological and spiritual frailty. That is universal human experience. But what happens historically is that certain categories of people who manifest that human frailty in spectacular or disturbing ways get treated differently from others. And that is what is disability, the social construction of the other person with impairments who confronts us in a particular way that shakes up our view about what it means to be human. And so I recognize it that way. I think in the social model, which is somewhat of a simplistic way of thinking about it, but it's helpful terminologically, is to say that one has an impairment or a condition or a diagnosis, but that one, through the response of the wider world, through medical systems, through education, through housing, transport, all of the areas where we touch into community life with each other, that people are made disabled. For me, I think that I'm happy to use the term disability when I'm in a social policy space and thinking about people who are made disabled in Australian society and what it is that we can unlock about the othering and bring people home, bring people back into community, bring people back into the shared paths of our lives. So I'll wear the disability because it is a strategic and pragmatic thing. And I identify as a disabled person who, even with all of the privilege and opportunity in my life, has had to deal with a world that's not built for me, moments of discrimination, moments of being overlooked, of belittling throughout my life. And so there's an element of me which is made disabled. But I find myself as a person who sits at the boundary of the world of disability and of the world of not disability, because many of the opportunities of my life have let me move freely in the world of not disability. And over time, I think that it's useful for disabled people like myself, people with impairments, to really try and see that we don't enclose ourselves in one identity as solely a disabled person, but that we find ourselves as people who live in boundaries, live in places where there's more fluidity, more opportunity to have a deeper and wider sense of ourselves, not shaped exclusively by the social patterning that's offered people with bodies like mine and minds that are not subject to control.
In some of the work that you've done, Lorna, you've traced the social patterning, I guess we can say, that has created disability, if we want to think about it in the terms of the social model. And I was really struck that the first institutions really for people deemed different in one way or another go back all the way to the medieval period in Europe. I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about how you see the origin of that and how it was accounted for back then.
There's sort of, once again, there's layers of history here, but one of the things that's important to see is that there are points throughout our history over the centuries where those people who are seen as out of control, confronting, challenging, are people who get gathered up. And so when we have a medieval worldview that still allows for notions of demon possession, of aligning those people who were falling into madness on the streets, all sorts of things like that, that those people need to be removed from the shared paths of everyday life. What I think happened at that point was that there was a kind of coalition between the beginnings of a social hygiene movement, which didn't really reach its high point until the late 19th and early 20th century, but a view that we needed to get these people out, at the same time that there was a view about treating people harshly in order to make their souls. And so the dominant theological view was that Jesus is perfected through the suffering on the cross, and the way in, because of the atonement for sin, and the way in which we deal with people who are obviously in a state of disgrace. They have fallen from God's grace. They may be demon possessed. They may be the product of sin of their parents, whatever it might be, is that we need to use suffering as a form of sanctification and uplift of these people. And so not only were people gathered up, but they were subjected to phenomenally harsh circumstances, forms of punishment, forms of spiritual abuse, in order to drive the disgrace from them and to reestablish them as possible to be considered part of Christendom.
By the time we get to, say, the 19th century, I mean, you've suggested, and among many others, that there is a materialist basis, really,
yes,
to the flourishing of the asylum in that century.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think the really sort of critical historical moments for us are the reform of the poor law in the 1830s, and that really drove much of the gathering up, or what I now call the sequestered generations, where those who were considered either impotent poor, and those are the words that were used were blind, lame, imbecilic, moronic, insane, lunatic, those people were brought into the asylums, initially presented as a place of sanctuary, hence the word asylum, developed by Quakers, but very quickly descended into places of extreme horror and abuse.
The poor laws and the poor houses that were so prevalent in England were kind of resisted in Australia. Do you think Australia's story is patterned in the same way?
Yes, I do, actually.
Right. Okay.
First of all, we have to think about the colonial history and what are the powers that the state has to control populations of people, and one of them is incarceration. And then the other part of it is the development of the asylum and all of that. So let's have a look at who was sent to Australia on those convict ships. If you have a look at some of the early records, you can see the colonial masters complaining about the disabled people who were sent, the old and frail people who were sent, the insane people who were sent. And so one of the reasons that we don't have the poorhouses in quite the same way is that the transportation to Australia was another mechanism that sat alongside the poorhouses to get rid of those people out of British society. And so they didn't need to have the containment that sat there in the poorhouse, which was in fact set up as a way of being so horrific that people would in fact take up employment, even though it was undesirable employment, to stay out of the poorhouse. What happened was that people didn't do that. They were criminalised, they were transported. And so the two policies sit side by side with each other. And so very, very quickly we had a beginning of this history of starting to lock people up. And if you look at the establishment of the institutions in Australia, we had prisons and we started this process of gathering up those people. And where they weren't gathered up, they became reliant on the benevolence of various people within the colony.
Lorna, this picture that's emerging from the way our society has responded to people deemed different in certain ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, it points to the potency of certain ideas, but also the power of institutions, economic mm-hmm. realities. It's a juggernaut.
It is.
It is such a juggernaut. And as someone who turned your face towards this to research it, to help narrate it, what was that like for you?
Yeah, I think I'm very lucky to have been studying theologically in a period when other social movements have started to give expression to some of the submerged themes within Christian theology. So when I started to do that, I could reach into feminist theology, queer theology, theologies developed by First Peoples in Australia and African Americans and marginalized people in other parts of the world. I was very lucky when I was in my early 20s to spend some time in South Korea and to discover Minjung theology. So
you'll have to tell me what that is now. I haven't come across it.
Minjung theology is the theology of the oppressed peoples. And it was the South Korean version of liberation theology. Huh. So what I found very, very early in this whole thing when I was hanging on to this sense that God is with me, and the title of my PhD is In My Flesh Shall I Know God, and hanging on to that was that it moved me quite quickly into this other stream of Christian history and Christian theology, alongside and being held by other people who had this struggle with the gorgeous God and the falling short. So that became very, really incredibly life-giving for me through the Australian Student Christian Movement, the Christian Conference of Asia, and then having the wonderful opportunity of being able to spend quite some time of my life just reading and thinking and writing about it from the perspective of disability, and then being involved with other people with disability thinking about this. Mm. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that I realized that what I could do in order to hold on to things was to give up things. And so there's a kind of a release from a whole lot of what I always think of as the goodness training that was part of my early childhood and adolescence. And so I was kind of liberated from that. It was very odd. I had a sense of liberation through becoming aware that I had moved into a part of human history that had previously been obscured from me.
Mm. That letting go, I mean, where did that leave the theodicy that was almost pushed on you as a teenager, that that impulse that so many people have to somehow justify God in the face of whatever horror is in front of us, something in the world, something in our immediate experience? Did you have to give up on a notion of God's goodness, God's power?
Yeah. For me, it was definitely not being able to hang on to any sense of power. Goodness, differently. I think I have, through the choices I've made and where I've located myself with people who are involved in this struggle, discovered what it really means for people to live the love rather than just keep preaching it. Where I've ended is that our sense of, maybe I can speak for Christians, I don't know, but is to incarnate God's love in the world. That's all we have to do. And I have experienced that so strongly with the people who've formed me over the last 50 years that I can hold on to the sense of God's love being active and present within our lives. But that is very, very different from a God who intervenes miraculously and sets the world at order. And so I think that the moment that we go to a God who embraces and enters into human life in all of its beauty and its horror, we have to relinquish the notion of God as a powerful king. And I feel really liberated not having to deal with that anymore.
Listening to you, Lorna, I wonder if some of the ways that love became clear in your experience might have been thanks to people who weren't themselves Christians.
Oh, yes, most definitely.
To just tell me more about...
Bolting from Christianity, some of them.
Yeah. Well, just tell me more about, like, when you say you experienced God's love through the people around you, like, what's behind that? What happened? Like, when did that surprise you or come upon you or...
It's not just me. One of the things when I was studying, doing some work on this history that I've been talking with you about is I've told you one strand of a story of disability. But what I also discovered was that there were families and communities and small church groups and everything that said, we are not handing this person over. They live with us. They belong with us. And so I've come across people who have embraced their family member with disability in the face of incredible challenges to yield to the expulsive forces, and they've held them. And so I've seen that, and I've seen what that means to deeply value, to cherish the place of people with disability in our lives, and to see that our lives are diminished when we don't do that. And so I think that's one part of it, but also because I've been involved in disability advocacy and disability policy circles, it's the acceptance that I get from other disabled people, which is so wonderfully reassuring and valuing for me. So I think wherever I see people who hold people with value, who respect dignity, who strive for rights, who are open to what it is that the disabled person can reveal to them about the nature of the world and about humanity and about our place in all of this. Doesn't matter what language they use, they can call me anything, but it's when I see that I think that we're engaging in what Carter Hay would call godding, the act of loving that is God.
How's that for a term? Godding. It was coined by Carter Hayward, who was an American feminist theologian and priest, describing acts of love that make the divine real. On ABC Radio National and by podcast, it's Meredith Lake with you for Soul Search, alongside disability scholar and advocate Lorna Hallahan. Lorna works in sociology at Flinders University, but along the way she's also done a doctorate in theology. And along with her own experience of living with a mobility impairment since she was a teenager, her research has sharpened her sense of what can be problematic and what can be life-giving in Christian thinking. You spoke earlier, Lorna, about some of the really unhelpful but theologically charged things that people said to you all those years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But this kind of disruptive, dignity-affirming, love-oriented godding, if I can borrow your word, it suggests that you still see a place for a theological, not just vocabulary, but perspective perhaps, in the way we as a community might together live well as neighbours, as family members and all those things, whatever our differences. I suspect that's not a common view perhaps in the world of disability advocacy or policy even. Why retain a place at all for theological perspectives?
You're not the first person to ask me that question, But I do most earnestly think that this is important. I think that it's important because it's a long and valued tradition inside Western thought. It's also a story that is about people struggling and yearning, about people's desire for connection, for belonging, for valuing, for being valued, for being beloved, for having community. And I think that despite all of the things for which we can condemn the Christian churches for, and I will add my voice to those condemnations, I think that there has always been this flickering, hopeful yearning to talk of beauty in the face of human suffering, to talk of connection, to talk of love, all of that. Why do I want to do it through Christian theology? That story is written so deeply into me, and it's something that I cherish and I want to hang on to. It has given me ideas, experiences, language, opportunities to explore some of the perhaps ineffable things of life. And I think that it's really important that we do not drop this, because if we do, we will return to seeing people as social problems to be solved, as medical complexes to be sorted out, as people to be put in one place or another. And I think that for me, Christian theology and that part of theology which is called anthropology, how do we understand the being of humans, always brings me back to something which is much richer and more important than the problem-saturated way in which we, despite our best efforts, continue to speak about disability as part of the human experience.
Part of the breakthrough, from what I've read of your work, Lorna, is moving from a theodicy
yes.
to an exploration of the incarnation. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are very technical theological terms.
yes.
But when you say incarnation, what do you mean? What are you pointing to?
It's a really vexed idea, and it's been tugged at and torn at and stretched at for centuries. But it's really the notion that in the life and work of Jesus, we see a revelation of God, that in Jesus there is a presence and a being which reveals to us something of God. Now, some people would say that that means that he was God, he arrived, put on human flesh like an overcoat, did his work and then popped back up into heaven. That's not where I see it. I think God is ineffable and beyond us. We don't have a tangible encounter except through this story that says in this man's life and his work and his teachings, we learn something really crucial about God and God's relationship to humanity. And so the incarnation for me is really about how we explore the question of God with us, which is the question of Advent and Christmas. How is God with us?
I guess I'm curious about where this leaves the question of suffering. I mean, you said earlier that sometimes the suffering of Christ is used in ways that paper over the reality of suffering in people's lives, or somehow described in ways that force an acceptance of, oh, it's all right then, it's got mm-hmm. some good outcome or something mm-hmm. like that.
Mm-hmm.
So is the suffering of Christ relevant to that question of how God is with us and how?
It's relevant only if we can accept that the incarnation is important. And the reason I say that is that when I had a look at how disability was being written about theologically by non-disabled theologians, they invariably went to the passion of Christ as a way of saying that person's suffering is Christ-like. And Christ-like is what happened to Jesus on the cross. And then we have another branch of of theology called soteriology, which is the theology of salvation, which says Jesus did that as a salvific act. Once we do that, we can find ourselves trapped in thinking that the suffering that we consider to be extra than just the human frailty that ends us all has some salvific purpose. And I think that's what the danger is, that somehow or other we place suffering in that way. I want to say that the suffering not only of the physical or mental diagnosis condition, but the way in which people are treated as a result of their human frailty does not have meaning in the Christ-like way. It does not happen. It's completely contingent on the fact that we're human beings. It's just there. But the important thing for us when we think about the incarnation is to say, the humanity which God embraces through the life and work of Jesus, it contains all of this. And so people with disability are not people in disgrace. They are people who are embraced through God in the work, life and work of Jesus. And so what that means is that we no longer think that people have to suffer to save something themselves or something else, but that we must diminish what we do to people that harms them. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes deeply ethical approach to it, which says we will not use theology as a mechanism to justify and continue the expulsion of people with impairments from our society.
So there's a kind of an acceptance of the meaninglessness of suffering that leads mm-hmm. to a kind of activism.
Yes, I think so. Because it says there are elements of what's happening in people's lives which are within our control. I got cancer, not within anyone's control. But if I had been trapped in the terrain of low expectations that so many disabled people have been trapped in and become stifled and depressed about my life, that is a social response. And if we want to draw a line with the incarnation, if we value people, we need to bring them back into our society and to acknowledge, work around, work with the nature of their impairments, but not never to use that as an excuse to say, you're not part of me.
Lorna, how do you think we're going with that as a community? I mean, we've seen the introduction of the NDIS, and I know you've been really involved in elements of mm-hmm. that and its mm-hmm. review and critique, mm-hmm. but I think we still have a profound ambivalence around our own frailty, collectively, individually.
Yes.
We resist interdependence
yes.
in many ways.
Yes.
And I guess what is your read of that?
I think you summed it up beautifully there, Meredith. I think that we have not yet settled in this nation of ours the fundamental question of what place disabled people in our society. And there are still strong expulsive forces masked with the language of care, alongside incredibly energetic, visionary, engaged, exhausted people who are doing the exact opposite. And so I remain optimistic. I don't think that this is a forever pattern in human societies. But I worry about the sorts of excuses that are used that say that this child can't be at school, the number of children being suspended and expelled from school because school environment causes them to become agitated and discombobulated in the classroom, and they get pushed aside for that rather than us asking really quite deep questions about how is it we construct classrooms that a percentage of children can't be at peace within them. And I think that that's a really core issue for us. I also worry about some of the techno-utopian talk, which I hear, which would have many people with disability seeking the company of non-human assistance.
So you're thinking of people who might turn to an AI companion of some kinds, or a robotic care provider, if we can call it that.
Yes, robotic care providers and AI companionship, that people live an isolated and disconnected world. They don't experience human touch tenderly. The only time they experience it is when things are being done to their bodies. And I think at the heart of that is a deep shame that there are so many messages that our society gives people that you are not worthy to be among us, are deeply shaming. And that's also partly going back to the theology question, why I think that theology has a place in helping people recover from shame.
The incarnation in particular, do you see that addressing shame specifically?
I do.
What's the connection there?
Well, it's because, I mean, Jesus was a man, so he was, and I don't mean that in he was a human being, and so he was a particular kind of human being at a particular point in history. But if we just step back one bit from it and say, here we are all these centuries later, why is it that we are so fascinated with that life? What is it that tells us something? And I think it is this idea that all people are loved by God. There's a universalism in it, which I really like. You don't have to be able to earn God's love by being a perfect specimen, a Greek godlike character, or a beautifully submissive woman, or anything like that.
You don't even have to suffer heroically for it.
No, you don't. And so that to me is just, it just feels like such a foundational concept which should be much more expanded upon and explored within Christian circles to claim something about our deeply shared humanity which starts to break down the possibilities of shame.
I mean, so often now we turn to the market to resolve challenges in our collective relationships.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it would look like if the kind of relationality that you're describing, we haven't used the word solidarity, but that's the one that's on the tip of my tongue.
If that became the organising, it's not
just a principle, but the organising impulse.
Yes.
In the way we responded to one another.
Yes. That's a fabulous question, Meredith. And I think it's interesting that you talk about the market. The notion that, to quote from Zygmunt Bauman, who was a sociologist, that in our post-industrial, late capitalist world, the poor might as well burn their tents and move on, being failed workers and consumers, tells us something about the harshness of the marketisation of human relations and the abandonment of so many people, and we only have to look at refugee flows around the world to see that. What I do know, because I've seen it and I've lived it, is that when people step away from just seeing people in those sorts of ways, that the only power one has is the power of a consumer, which is very, very, very weak for people with compounded disadvantage, is that there's a solidarity, a deep affiliation across people who, to use a feminist theologian word, know otherwise, that we can see each other as human beings in a different light. And what I have seen is the flourishing of freely given relationships, the ways in which families come together to support their disabled family member, how families then support each other to do this, how they enter into difficult struggles around inclusion, how they celebrate their family members, how they surround those people with love, with risk to allow them to grow, how they speak with such deep respect of their family members, how they then talk about how this experience has opened for them deeper wisdoms that they never thought they would be enchanted by, really. And so I've had people say, this child with disability has saved my life, has shown me what really matters in the world. And I think theology, in the way that I think about it, has got something to say about what really matters. So it's those sorts of things. I know it, I've seen it, I've lived it. It's possible.
You use the word enchantment. Mm. It's partly about the imagination.
Mm-hmm. It is. Mm. In fact, there's a, you know, C. Wright Mills talked about the sociological imagination, which was about making the familiar strange and thinking, why does the world have to be like this? This is strange. This is odd. But there's another part of it, which is making the strange familiar. Those people who've been estranged from us because of all of these historical, theological, economic, sociological forces become familiar to us, become part of our family.
Well, finally then, Lorna, I wonder what Advent involves for you. Is it something that gives rise to certain practices at all or reflections, or how do you approach this time
of
year?
Well, I belong to a very small and somewhat ageing Christian community of people who are, all of them carry wounds from across their lives. Some of them are seriously ill, others living with disability. And so these people are people whom I cherish and I feel cherished by. And our conversations with each other about these things really matter. And what I find is that they are more people of questions than solutions, more open to experiencing their spiritual lives alongside and with each other. And just sitting with the question of what does it mean for God to be with us and not having to resolve that. So they're people of what I think of as the frayed edge, the unfinished business. And when we think that our work together is love, that is always an unfinished business. It is always uncertain. It has glorious moments and moments of terrible loss and sadness, but it's something that we do together, and that's what I'll do.
Lorna Hallahan, who's observing Advent, like Christians all over the world, in the weeks leading up to Christmas. Lorna did a PhD in disability theology some 20 years ago now, but she spent decades working as a disability scholar and advocate. You can hear more about her work in connection with the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS, in a past episode of Radio National's Rear Vision. You'll find the link to that on the Soul Search homepage. But I hope you've enjoyed a more theological meditation on disability just now, and on that big question of how we might become a more inclusive and loving society. December the 3rd is the International Day of People with Disability, and you can read and hear lots more stories right across your ABC. If you've enjoyed this conversation, why not share Soul Search with a friend? And of course, you're always very welcome to get in touch and share your thoughts with me. For now, thanks to Soul Search producers Rowan Sammons and Hong Jiang. I'm Meredith Lake, signing off from Arunda Country today. Thanks for your company, by podcast, on Radio Australia and on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.